Silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, before we begin, we do have some high school students from Baraboo High School who are supposed to come, but they haven't arrived yet. So if you hear folks coming in the back of the courtroom, don't let it bother your argument. We like them to come. Sometimes they don't get here quite on time. Buses are what they are. So are you prepared? Well, let me see. I should probably call the case before I ask if you're prepared to begin. So now Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development versus Wisconsin LERC. Are you all ready to go? Please do.
May it please the court, Brian Walsh, Chief Deputy Solicitor General, on behalf of the Department of Workforce Development. The doctrine of great weight deference and the statute that prescribes the standard of review for commission orders like the one in this case are in conflict. Now, under 10809, while it's generally true that the commission's findings of fact are conclusive and ought to be regarded as, in some sense, binding on the court, there is nothing in 10809 sub 7 that directs this court to take a similarly deferential approach to the agency's conclusions of law. Quite to the contrary, 10809 sub 7 says that this court and other courts in Wisconsin are to sit in review of commission orders to determine whether the commission has acted without or in excess of its authority. As that statutory phrase was interpreted by this court in the early to mid-20th century, in a number of foundational cases under the workers' compensation statute, as well as the unemployment insurance law, this court went out of its way to review questions of statutory meaning de novo, without paying any great weight to the agency's views. To take a few examples, an international harvester, 3 years after the workers' compensation statute was passed, this court was asked, did the commission act in excess of its authority by interpreting a word in the statute a certain way?
I think we can all agree with you that the doctrine of deference and its three levels developed over a period of time. It just didn't spring full-blown way back. Okay, so I understand that. I'm more interested in whether we should continue what we have used in many, many cases, those three level of deferences, and I think we've pretty much set out the factors that are present and when they are, which level applies when an agency's determination is under review. I think you know that I haven't agreed with great weight deference for a long time, since I wrote about it way back in 2006. But what I'd like you to address for me is, should the court say, well, we're going to disregard those three tests, or should the court say, well, we're just not going to use great weight deference anymore? That's just too much deference. Or should the court say, we're just going to apply statutory factors rather than any of the factors set out in, say, due weight deference? What should we do?
I think option two and option three are actually consistent in this case.
Okay.
So as to great weight, we'd ask that you set it aside because it conflicts with the statute that the legislature has enacted, and as this court held in Beecher, when the legislature prescribes a standard of review for agency orders, it's that standard that governs, and if this court were to disregard it, it would be invading on the province of the legislature. So setting that aside, there's also the separation of powers concerns, which I can elaborate on. Setting that aside, the question becomes what to do with due weight. Now, as this court has framed the due weight inquiry in more recent cases, it has become clear that due weight deference is a misnomer. Deference means adopting the judgment of another person because the other person has come to that judgment. What this court does in due weight is that it always interprets the statute as it would in any other case, applying the traditional tools of statutory interpretation and arriving at the most reasonable, that is, the correct meaning of the statute. Now, if it happens that the correct meaning of the statute is also the agency's view of the statute, then you're, of course, adopting the agency's view. But not because it's the agency's view. It's because the agency, through perhaps its expertise, its special experience, its the discretion conferred upon it, has arrived at an answer that is, in your judgment, correct.
Mr. Walsh, counsel,
if I may, can you cite to any case since the 1911 Borgenes case that was kind of the platform for this agency and agency review, can you cite to any case where this court has given great weight deference and had an analysis that says we think that the correct and better interpretation of the statute is XYZ, I'm using that for a filler, but the agency has interpreted as ABC, and we're going to give, even though ours is better, ours is the correct one, we're going to defer. Can you point to any case where we've done that?
I can't think of one, but it's for a particular reason, which is that in the modern deference doctrine era, this court no longer feels the need in every case to construe the statute independently first. The question is immediately, is the agency's particular view in this case reasonable? And this court has repeated again and again that because that's the question, we don't have to construe the statute ourselves.
I think that I can't think of a case, because, first of all, I haven't researched it, but I can't think of a case, none comes to mind at all, because I don't think this court would ever say the correct interpretation, the more reasonable interpretation is XYZ, but we're of this statute, but we're not going to follow it.
I don't think
you're going to find a case that says that. And so I'm wondering if all of this is much ado about not a lot.
Well, then with respect, Your Honor, I think you would need to withdraw language from more recent cases that suggests the reasonable, minimally reasonable interpretation of the agency controls, even if we can find a more reasonable interpretation. The court has said that, but I agree, I can't think of a case in which this court has discovered a more reasonable meaning on its own, and that's precisely because the court sees no need to in many of these cases, and that's the problem in great weight.
I don't think that this court has ever looked at a statute and then closed its eyes and says, we're not going to interpret it. Inherent in us taking a case, inherent in us reviewing the statute, is that we try to discern a meaning of it. I mean, we don't say, oh, this agency has lots of experience and it's been delegated this responsibility and go through the requirements, and therefore, let's just close our eyes and close our ears. We don't care what we think it means. That's absurd to me.
Well, that doesn't sound... Let me ask, please. Counsel, I think the last three questions, to my ear, have all been based on a premise that would include either this court or some other reviewing court engaging in an independent review of the statute, which your first, the response to Justice Ann Bradley's first question, you said, and it kind of got swallowed up either because you're talking too fast or maybe there was talking over you from the bench or something. But I want to hear your response again, because I think it kind of got lost. You didn't ask a question. It's my turn to ask a question.
You didn't ask one, ma'am.
You said you thought that was absurd. You thought that was absurd.
I want you to respond to me why it isn't absurd.
Then you can wait until I'm done with my question.
Well, I want your response. Behavior.
Yeah.
Justice Gableman, finish your question
To hear your response. I'll bet you could find hundreds of cases where the court says it doesn't matter if we can think of a more reasonable or what we would think is a better result. It doesn't matter because Our precedent says it doesn't matter. And so, therefore, we will certainly review the statute, and we will interpret it, the outcome that the agency and the lower court and the courts below came to, and we will try to arrive to determine whether those outcomes were reasonable, but we will base it within the confines of how that issue has been framed, including deference. That I'll bet you could find hundreds to, yes?
Yes, I think here is a helpful contrast.
You're answering his question.
I view the questions as related, but yes, I'm answering Justice Gableman's question. The question of what the statute truly means under the traditional tools of statutory interpretation is short-circuited by this court's more recent doctrine that it need not go there if the agency has proffered a reasonable interpretation. And the practical effect of that analytical move is that the court doesn't first do the hard work that it does in non-agency cases of trying to figure out the meaning and then turn to the agency's view.
It doesn't do the hard work of what?
It doesn't do the hard work of applying the traditional tools of statutory interpretation, figuring out
independently, you mean?
Independently, that's right. Correct. That's correct. And instead, the analysis is short-circuited so that the court is right off the bat looking at the agency view. Now, contrast that with this court's approach in Boynton Cab, 1941. This is a foundational case in this area of the law. In Boynton Cab, the question is, what is misconduct within the meaning of the unemployment insurance law? The court said, as we look at it, it's ambiguous. There are several possible meanings. But our job, when faced with such an ambiguity, is to determine, quote, the true meaning of the statute, which is what the court then did in paragraph after paragraph. It adopted a meaning of misconduct, which then the legislature later codified, by the way. So that's the contrast. And what we're asking the court to do is to take that approach, the approach under 10809 of independently determining the meaning of the act.
And so, therefore, your response to the previous set of questions/statements that were made would be premised on the fact that not only it's not that the court or our court, this court, or other reviewing courts are unable or unwilling to do the heavy lifting of an independent review. It is that we are proscribed from doing so by the framework that has been set up. And so, therefore, you would not expect to find an independent review from a reviewing court that therefore yields a product that the writing court would proclaim as superior to the result of the agency, but then not only expressly say, this is how we would do it, and then expressly say, and we think it's a better result than what was reached below. But our law prohibits us from applying what we think is a better result, so we're going to go along with the worst result, because it meets the bare minimum of reasonableness. I mean, that simply would be absurd from the legal construct that the appellate courts are operating under now. Yes?
Yeah, you might say that it would be an opinion full of a lot of dicta. It would be unnecessarily long, and it wouldn't be getting to the core of the question under this court's current great weight rule, which is simply whether the agency's view is minimally rational.
Assuming the statute is ambiguous, then you go on to utilize traditional tools of statutory construction. That's what you're urging the court to adopt. What, if any, role does an agency's interpretation have in that analysis then? Is it extrinsic evidence? Is it something to consider, but just consider it like any other source? Where would you put the agency's interpretation? Would it depend if they were experts, if they had a long line of precedent? What would you do with that?
I think it would depend, Your Honor. I think consistent with the approach that the Department of Justice on behalf of the state has urged in Tetra Tech, there are certain factors that should be inputs in this court's interpretation of what the law means. They they are important inputs in this case, not because they're in 227, because 227, as we all know, does not apply in this case. They're important because they go to the agency's power to persuade. So in a particular case, it might be that the agency's expertise, specialized knowledge, discretion will help this court figure out the answer of what the law is. But other times, it won't. I think the Chief Justice brought up a very good example of this in her law review in the Marquette, in her piece in the Marquette Law Review. She said, in workers' compensation cases where there's a question of whether the employer has denied payment to an employee who is owed payment for bad faith, it's a legal question, but it's fact intensive. And agencies who deal with these kinds of claims all the time have a good sense of what would be a reasonable mechanism adopted by an employer to determine whether there has been some kind of fraud on the part of the employee. You know, what kind of investigators should we hire? What are the standards in the industry? These are questions, again, very fact-intensive parts of the legal inquiry that I think the court benefits from the agency's presentation. But that doesn't mean that the agency's presentation is in any way binding. It is as persuasive as it is persuasive based on the kinds of considerations in 227, 57, 10, as well in cases like the Skidmore decision from the Supreme Court of the United States. It says, well, we'll evaluate whether the interpretation of the agency rests on experience, expertise, we'll evaluate the validity of its reasoning, the thoroughness of its consideration. These are factors that I think are just part of a good approach to judging.
Is this any different than the how we benefit, this court benefits from the analyses of the lower courts when we have an issue under consideration? We don't defer to what the Court of Appeals has said or what a circuit court judge has ruled, but we give it some consideration. We may accord it more weight in some cases, less weight in other cases, but I don't see how that equates to deference.
Yeah, I think that is consistent with the approach that I'm defending. There might be differences in the margins, of course, because the Court of Appeals, the skill set of the Court of Appeals is very much the skill set of this court, whereas the skill set of an agency in a fact-intensive case with a broad statute might be a little different, but in principle, it is the same, that you benefit from the analysis of a person who is able to perform that analysis well, given the circumstances of the case. And again, the critical component of this due weight approach, this respectful consideration approach, as Your Honor put it in Opperton, is that the court is always interpreting the statute and giving it its true meaning, even in the face of abstract ambiguities on the face of the statute.
I'd like to return to boredness. Mm-hmm. And in boredness, as I recall, the argument was akin to an argument being advanced today. That is, that the then newly minted workers' compensation law was unconstitutional, quote, because it vests judicial power in a body which is not a court and is not composed of men elected by the people, in violation of those clauses of the state constitution which vests the judicial power in certain courts and provides for the election of judges by the people. That's from Borgness at page 358. Isn't that what's being advanced here to attack the great weight deference standard? And wasn't it addressed at least implicitly in Borgness?
The court in Borgness held that the commission did not invade upon the judicial power because in every case in which a commission order was at issue, the question of whether the agency had the power to act in the first place was always an open question. And that is the critical difference. There's language in Borgness about paying respect to the agency's view of the body of evidence in front of it along the lines of language you see in a court of appeals opinion about a lower court opinion, as just mentioned. But the critical difference is the right of the agency to act in the first place, and I'm paraphrasing, is always a question in the court when the order is challenged, and that is why the commission does not exercise final adjudicative authority as the courts in the Wisconsin system do. That's the difference.
Well, that's just saying that the agency's decision about its own jurisdiction is not final, right?
It is, but jurisdiction had a very special meaning in that context. 108.09.7 says power. And as the Supreme Court of the United States put it in Pulliam, in the parlance of the time, it was thought that an entity, including a court, acted in excess of its jurisdiction anytime it misconstrued some substantive law. Now, courts have since got away from that idea with respect to the idea of a jurisdiction of a court under a constitutional system, as again the court explained in Pulliam. But it has not gotten away from that idea with respect to an agency, because the question with an agency, the question of whether it has the power to act and whether it is acting correctly under the substantive law is always the same. That's what the Supreme Court said, actually, in 2013 in the City of Arlington case.
In essence, that is, you are acting in excess of your jurisdiction if you are acting contrary to law. I mean, it's one and the
yes.
same.
Mm-hmm. For an agency, yes. For a court, no.
Yes.
That's exactly it. And the early cases reflect this understanding. Not just Borgnes, but some of the others I've mentioned, International Harvester, Northwestern Iron, and the Brown case from 1960, which is striking because in that case the court actually rejected the agency view out of hand without any discussion of the three-tier deference system, because it thought that the meaning of the statutory term accident within the meaning of the workers' compensation statute had simply a different meaning in light of the evidence existing at the time that that statute was enacted. Again, it's a marked contrast to the great weight approach that that the court uses today.
What about the interpretation of 108.04.5e, I guess it is? If we, by your argument, and we interpret the statute ourselves, we could still agree with the interpretation that Lurk gave to the statute, correct?
You could, except that you shouldn't, because
okay,
the statute
well,
is not ambiguous.
That was going to be my next question. How do you suggest that Lurk's interpretation is not correct if we're starting with the words of the statute?
This is a recent provision passed by the legislature, written in plain, ordinary English. It says that misconduct includes absenteeism when a worker misses work on more than two occasions within a 120-day period, unless otherwise specified by the employer in a manual given in writing to the employee and acknowledged by that employee with a signature. This is not an unclear provision. The plain language of unless otherwise specified points you to the source of the governing rule where the unless clause is satisfied, namely the employer manual, which will have a different standard of absenteeism. Now, the Commission responds, and it's important that I address this, the Commission responds that actually what the Department is doing is writing in language of its own. The Commission argues that under our view of the statute, it says, unless otherwise specified, dot, 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 in which case the employer policy governs. But that's not correct, and I think a comparison will show you why that is not a correct argument. Suppose that my employer tells me that attire at the workplace shall be business attire, unless it is Friday. Now, when the unless clause is satisfied there, we don't know what I'm supposed to wear on Friday. It could be business casual, it could be casual, it could be Hawaiian shirts. But if the sentence is instead, attire at the workplace shall be business attire, unless an email is sent the night before specifying otherwise, now we know that when the unless clause is satisfied, there's an email, we know where to look to find the rule that governs in that situation. We look at the email to find out what we're supposed to be or what would be appropriate to wear on Friday. So the Commission has a point that unless, if it's read in a vacuum, can have this meaning where you don't know what the rule is, but it's not in a vacuum here. It's unless otherwise specified. Now, another point about that provision is that it places a premium on there not only being an employer policy, but on there being an employer policy in writing, given to the employee, and acknowledged by that employee with his or her signature. I think that what that tells you is that the employer policy is going to be important. We want the employee to be on notice of what it says. Because if you do violate its absenteeism standard, there can be consequences under the unemployment insurance law.
Does the statute address the issue and answer the issue of whether an employee, excuse me, an employer can have a policy more restrictive than the two occasions set forth in sub E.
More restrictive is a tricky term here, but yes, where there is an employer policy, the policy could be that if you're absent on more than one occasion with a 120-day period.
So you think the statute speaks to whether or not sub 2, excuse me, whether the number two occasions is a floor, or is the statute silent on that?
The statute tells you it's a default standard. The 2 and 120 policy governs unless the employer policy specifies otherwise, in which case the employer policy is the source of the definition of absenteeism. Mm-hmm. So
how do you know
what
that?
Your honors, I'm sorry?
How do you know that?
Well, as I hope my example showed, there are cases in which when a legislature uses the language unless otherwise specified, it's telling you what the rule is when the unless clause is satisfied. And we cited a number of examples.
There's a canon of construction also that words used, the same word used in different statutes can mean different things. So
that's
you're dragging in and perfectly valid in the sense of persuasiveness, but not controlling other statutes where unless is interpreted in a certain way or the statute is interpreted in a certain way.
That's true, but in this statute, unless is used 19 times. And a very similar construction actually shows up in... May I finish?
Yes, you finish.
A very similar construction shows up under this particular subsection. If an employee...
In all 19 times?
No, a few of them are in this subsection. Others are in other parts of the statute.
Okay.
Thank you, Counsel.
If I might, something puzzles me about this. We have two executive departments, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And rather than settling this dispute between two executive departments in the executive branch, you come to court to settle it. Why?
Well, I guess you'd have to ask the Department of Workforce Development because they sued us. They have that authority under 10809.
Well, you didn't make the argument in here that this should have been settled in the executive branch, not in the... judicial branch. I mean, that's what we're doing here. We're settling two executive department fighting, and you're coming to court instead of doing it in the executive branch.
But you also have an independent private party who either will get money for unemployment comp or won't, right?
Right.
But that person is not on any of these briefs. Do you represent any party? Do you represent, who is this? Mr. Carlson, is it?
No, I'm Jeffrey Shample for the Labor and Industry Review Commission. I represent the Labor and Industry Review Commission.
That's right. I didn't see on your briefs that anyone is representing the individual here.
No, they've never appeared, nor have
they. They've never appeared. So this is a fight between two executive agencies, right?
Right. But once the department sued us, then we filed an answer and responded. And we have the duty to apply the statute independently using our judgment.
I understand that, but I still find it somewhat disconcerting. Not unusual. We can find lots of cases where two executive agencies come to court to settle a dispute, but I just want to know, have you considered, if it's in the record, I probably is not, just doing it the executive branch level rather than here?
Well, that would require LURC to agree with the interpretation of the department, and LURC is the reviewing agency for the department, so we feel like we have our own duty to apply the statute the way it's written, and then the department sued us.
Counsel, is it fair enough to say that you're here because this court has the final say on what the law says?
Yes.
Okay. That doesn't stop parties from settling disputes, does it?
I don't believe that we have the authority under the unemployment statute to settle disputes. I know we can't with private parties because it's a program that, in fact, there's federal involvement, and we have to do what the law says, and we can't settle cases for a lesser amount or a different amount. Now, between the agencies, it would have required basically us to have said, yes, we agree with the department, or the department to say, yes, we agree with LURC.
Right.
Counsel, rather than dig into things that are not in the record and are really of no import to our decision at all, I wonder if you would start with your argument.
Sure. Again, I'm Jeffrey Shampoo. I represent the Labor and Industry Review Commission. May it please the court. This court's practice of giving deference, including great weight deference, to reasonable agency interpretations fully comports with Article 7, Section 2 of the Wisconsin Constitution. Finding otherwise would result in overruling the standards applied in hundreds of cases on review of numerous state agencies involving not just workers' compensation and unemployment, but employment relations, public utility, transportation, natural resources, tax, and probation. It would also affect the judicial review of the decisions of local boards and agencies on issues like zoning, tax assessment, and employment relations. It will result in long-standing, and this, I think, is the key.
Would you be kind enough to pull the microphone a little closer to you?
A little closer? I'm
yes,
sorry.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
And I think this is the key to why we believe great weight deference should apply. These are long-standing interpretations of agencies that have stood for years without intervention by the legislature.
But it's been a development over time, as your opposing counsel has noted, and now it, you know, we have three cases today, and they all have as a common denominator, they touch upon the question that you just started talking about, which is the constitutionality. You took the affirmative, yes, it comports with Section 7 article. But the time has arisen to address the question. Unless you were sitting in the audience for the first oral argument, you did not have the opportunity to hear me ask the question of one of the counsel, of the chief solicitor for the state. What's the real difference from a constitutional standpoint of a court giving great weight deference, of setting aside what the court thinks might be a better interpretation and deferring to an agency interpretation? Many times the agency has a dog in the fight. The agency has an interest in the outcome. And I ask the question about what if a law firm, say even like a public policy law firm, and they're springing up, you know, all over, and they have been, and they say, we're going to develop a specific area of expertise, and it's going to have, we're going to focus on nothing except wrongful terminations or something like that on this particular issue. And we're going to develop a body of expertise. And I asked the Solicitor General, well, what, from a constitutional perspective, what's the difference between a court giving deference to an agency who's developed an expertise over the years versus a law firm, a public interest law firm? Now, the answer I got was a good one, and that answer was because the legislature has delegated its authority for rulemaking to the... But the more I've thought about it in between then and now, and this is what I pose to you, is to... Maybe that kind of begs the question a little bit, because from my perspective, what's bothering me a little bit and what I'm really trying to work at is, as far as the legislature delegating its authority and its power, I don't have much of a problem with that. But to the extent that the legislature somehow wants to delegate purported authority or claimed authority that it has over us, the court. So we are the final arbiter of what the law in this state is. There's only one court in the land that can review us, as you know. So tell me the answer, your answer to that, with the background and the context.
Okay, the most direct and easiest answer, and I'll go beyond it, is that we don't have a dog in the fight. We are, and so is DWD, we're charged with deciding the dispute between an employee and an employer.
Okay,
the next
enough.
Answer, though...
But oftentimes, I guess I was...
In other agencies,
yes.
I agree. Other agencies may have a dog in the fight.
Right.
There's two ways I want to respond to this, and one is, as far as it goes to statutory interpretation of statutes that agencies have been charged with enforcing, that's a shared authority. The court has recognized this in the past. It's a shared authority between the courts and the executive agency. Now, of course, the court has the ultimate authority. It's the final body that sees it. It's ultimate in the sense that it's last, and also ultimate in the sense it finally decides. But it's a shared authority. And there is a prior case, In Re Constitutionality of Section 5118, and it says that when you have a shared authority, the branches are supposed to cooperate with each other or show generous cooperation with one another. And I think that the great weight deference standard and the practical construction rule, and that's the rule that Mr. Teslin was talking about at the beginning, the 200-year-old rule that courts will, if there's a practical construction of a statute by the agency who's supposed to be enforcing it, they will, sometimes they say they give a great weight, sometimes they say they give a controlling weight. But that's because that agency has dealt with it many times over many years. The legislature hasn't intervened. And I think when you look at it that way, the great weight deference standard, which the court itself imposes on itself, is almost like a statutory construction rule, almost like the rule that, and I guess given that, I think that it's an appropriate and not an invasion.
Let me ask one final.
And I have one more point.
I don't want to interrupt you.
One point quickly. This very issue, too, was addressed in Borgness. In Borgness, the court, in addition to what Justice Bradley referred to, it said that legal conclusions of the commission could be given great dignity and respect and not upset by courts unless they were, and I think it said contrary or, I forget what it said exactly, but they're supposed to be given great dignity and respect. And,
well,
and that follows into with deference. And I'm interrupting you now. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. What was the last thing you said?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I'm done.
Okay. Let me just ask one last question, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues. The question I was going to ask related to a question that Justice Rebecca Bradley asked much earlier in these proceedings, and it had to do with a comparison of the deference that we give to our court gives to our lower courts, our courts of appeal, and our circuit courts. Now, we have a different standard when it comes to the factual findings of they shall not be disturbed unless contrary to a reasonable fact finder could not so find under the circumstance. But when it comes to conclusions of law, we don't even give to our own circuit and courts of appeal any level of deference. We accept what you just said at the very last, dignity and respect. We have a stock quote that appears in our opinions where we're reviewing those questions, and it says, we are not bound by their conclusions of law, but we may benefit from their interpretations. And we always put that in, and we do. And sometimes one of the criteria we'll use to not accept, for instance, a petition for bypass will be because, I don't think I'm giving any great secrets from the conference room, but I remember the late Justice Crooks, and he and I saw eye to eye on this. It's like sometimes sometimes we really do benefit from what the Court of Appeals has to say, and we want to hear their issue, their opinions on a controversial matter. And we want to hear their reasoning. We want to hear what might not be the same view as the seven of us or any subset thereof may hold, because of that dignity and respect, or as our stock language says, we may benefit therefrom. Why shouldn't the same be for agencies?
Well, agencies are charged by the legislature to enforce specific sections of the law, so they're different than courts of general jurisdiction. And
well, they're charged with enforcing the law, too. But anyway.
But as a result of having this specific thing,
you're talking the specific thing being the legislature.
Yeah, having a specific area of authority, an agency will hear a lot of cases before it ever goes to court and get a great number, issue a great number of decisions involving perhaps many people. And again, it passes without the legislature stepping in and saying it was wrong, and then it goes to court the first time. And it could have been years and years before the case goes to court on that issue. Now, in this case, of course, it's a brand new statute, and we only got due weight deference. And the other thing, too, is, again, in Borgness, the Supreme Court did say that such a board may lawfully be endowed with very broad powers and its conclusions given great dignity and force. It wasn't respect, I misspoke. Great dignity and force, so that courts may not reverse them unless the proof be clear and satisfactory that they are wrong. Now, in the arguments in this case, the other side, and I believe the amicus too, has made the point, well, that's just talking about application. But again, the court has said in order to execute or apply the law, agencies have to interpret it too.
Counsel, I'd like to focus on that point just a moment. Page 2 of your brief, you say that interpretation of a statute enforced by an administrative agency is a shared authority. And I'm wondering, it seemed to me, and perhaps you can correct me on this, that is conflating two separate concepts, one of which is, yes, interpreting a statute is something that both the executive and the judicial branches do versus a shared authority in doing that, right?
I understand exactly what you're saying, and I think the court answered this question, too, in the In Re Constitutionality of 251.18. Because I can get the exact page, but there is a discussion in there where the court's talking about the doctrine of the separation of powers. And it says there's a great borderland, there are relatively few exclusive or core powers, and then a great borderland of shared powers. And then the court says, for example, and it gives us an example of an executive power, the courts do receivership. And it gives an example of interpretive or the power of interpretation. It gives the practical construction rule. And in that case, it said that this is an example of a shared power that's permissible under the separation of powers.
Then is there any power that the court has that is unique to it?
Oh, many, many powers.
I mean, but it's not interpreting statutes.
I don't think it's unique to the court. I think in this case the court has the ultimate. It ultimately says what the statute means.
Right. So hang on a second. I want to make sure that I'm not going to talk past you. Certainly, the executive has the obligation to interpret statutes, and not just when an administrative agency is tasked with enforcing it. Right. The executive enforces all the statutes.
Right.
But that doesn't. But that's in its realm when it's acting as the executor of the law. Right. This is when there is a case, and we have to decide what the law means. Shared authority would suggest that the executive can come in here and exercise authority and a vote in deciding what the statute means. You don't mean to say that, do you?
No.
Okay. So would it be correct to say then that you are simply observing a factual matter? The executive must interpret the statute to do its job. We interpret statutes to do our job, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And when we're interpreting the statutes to do our job, that's exclusive to us, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I think you have to read the 215-18 case because it does talk about the practical construction rule in terms of shared authority. On the other hand, in the Gabler case that was just recently issued in, I think it's paragraph 46, the court made the point that exercising its independent judicial authority is a core power of the court. And we agree with that, of course. But what we're saying is when it's exercising that authority, it's reasonable for the court to have a rule where they defer to longstanding interpretations of by agencies, because that goes back to the practical construction rule the courts followed since the 1800s.
But you're suggesting that this is a rule that we must follow, yes?
It's the rule that you have now.
Okay. But we can just decide that we don't want it anymore then, right?
The deference standards that the courts imposed?
Right.
Yeah, those are judicially created standards.
So there's nothing in the Constitution that requires that we have this.
Well, the only thing that there would be that comes close, I suppose, again, is the language from Borgness when it was talking at the very beginning about the commission's powers, and it said, may lawfully be endowed with very great powers and its conclusions given great dignity and force. So there, then, the court kind of set the stage for giving agency conclusions.
Right, but that's just something that we said. That wasn't founded in the Constitution.
Well, but it was what you said when you were interpreting the Constitution.
I'd like to bring your attention to WSSTAT Section 102.23 on judicial review, subsection 1E. And I would like you to tell me whether the criteria for judicial review set in that subsection are equated, in your view, with great weight deference, due weight deference, or there's something totally different?
I don't think the deference standards are set out in 102.23.
Okay,
that's
so
workers' comp.
But
I'm asking him about 102.23. I understand that. Okay, I'm just asking you if those standards, and if you don't know, that's a fair answer. Do they equate with the deference standards that we set by common law, those statutory standards?
Well, one of them is acting in excess of the commission's authority,
right.
And in Borgness. Again, the court was looking at that, and it said, as long as it doesn't act in excess of its authority, its conclusions may be given great dignity and force.
Okay, all right.
I would make one other point, too, and I think this got a little bit confused. This case actually is reviewed under 102.23. It was one of the last ones just before they changed the statute.
That's right. I was looking at it, and part of your argument is that statutory interpretation is a shared power, and I thought part of what you were saying is that in fact, the sharing is written out by the legislature. If you're going to review, then you're going to look at these items for review, which is why I wanted to get your view on where does the statutory directives fit within the common law standards that you're asking us to continue. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, and okay. I don't know if it would be in 102.23. I think it would be more likely in the sections that give the department and the commission the authority to decide cases.
Okay, I'm not making myself clear, but that's fine. I'll think about it.
Counsel, what are the implications for circuit courts or the development of the law if there is no deference accorded to any agency determination?
You said circuit courts?
Or
any courts?
Or the development of the law, of course, would encompass beyond circuit courts.
I think what would happen would be there isn't any deference, then the courts don't have to follow, you know, the interpretation of the agency. You could get a whole bunch of different interpretations from all the circuit courts. And then over time, I suppose, maybe that would pass through into the Court of Appeals and you would get a precedent decision. I don't know for sure that it would. But it would be, I think it would be overlooking the significance of the longstandingness of the agency interpretation and allowing kind of a free hand to courts to say what they thought the statute meant. I have the feeling I didn't answer your question.
No, that's fine. Let's take a look at the statute. You think it's ambiguous, apparently.
Yes, we do.
And tell me why you think it's ambiguous.
Well, I think it's ambiguous for three reasons. First, using the word unless doesn't say what the consequence is. If they gave an example, I'm going to give one too. You can have the example, the plant will die unless you water it. Okay? If you water the plant, it may still die. Just because, you know, what that statute clearly means is if you don't water the plant, it will die. And what this statute clearly means is if there's no manual from an employer, then the statutory standard applies. It doesn't say what happens if there is a manual standard. Do we apply the manual standard if it's reasonable? Manuals set out requirements for notice and the length of absence, the length of lost time that constitutes an absence. Do we apply those too? Or do we do what the commission did and say, well, if there's a manual, then we look at both, the manual standard and the standard set out in the statute. And the statute's ambiguous for another reason, and that is because it defines misconduct. And manuals from employers generally don't define misconduct. They define the level of absence that results in the discharge. So you have this tension between the statute defining disqualifying misconduct and the manuals that define the level that results in a discharge. And the courts in the past have recognized these are very different things.
Well, couldn't the employer have written the manual so it complies with the words of the statute? And, I mean, she had to sign off on it, and that was also required by the statute.
Yeah, she did sign off on it. But my point is that their manual didn't say it was misconduct. Their manual said you would be discharged.
Right, well, grounds for discharge.
Isn't that an assumption or an inference that if you're discharged for this particular activity, it's misconduct?
Within the definition of the unemployment statute, I don't know
generally.
That. Generally, I wouldn't make that assumption. I think she was a probationary employee.
That's
other
right.
Employees.
And the manual said if you were a probationary person and you didn't call in, you're gone.
Yeah, and the courts have recognized in the past that employers have rules that govern their efficient operation, but that doesn't automatically equate with disqualifying misconduct.
And right. Unless the statute says so, right? So we have in the law a well-known concept of incorporating something by reference, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the statute says, here's your default provision, unless otherwise specified in an employment manual. It's incorporating that manual by reference.
I don't think it necessarily follows that it's incorporating the manual by reference. It doesn't. When you incorporate by reference, you say, we're incorporating the provisions of by reference.
No, when you incorporate something by reference, you do it by referring to it. You can say that you're incorporating it by reference, but that's not necessary. Right? This necessarily incorporates it because it says, unless otherwise specified. So that drives you to the employment manual to see if there's a condition that is different from the default provided by the statute, doesn't it?
Yeah, and if there is, then the default statute alone won't apply. But I don't think that statute says what happens next. I don't think that statute says then the standard in the manual supplants the
okay.
statute.
So then tell me, would your read of the statute be any different at all if instead of the word unless introducing this clause, the word was and?
It would be. We would reach the same reading.
Right.
They both have to apply.
Isn't that a problem that you would reach the same conclusion, even though the words are totally different? And unless have very distinct meanings in English.
But again, I think they wouldn't necessarily, that would almost assume that there is a manual standard.
Okay. Well, yes, it does, because it says unless otherwise specified, which requires you to go to the manual.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
It would requires you to go to the manual to see if there is another standard that is specified, right?
I think all it does is require you to see if there's another standard that's specified. I don't think it requires that you apply that standard.
Then what does the unless mean?
The unless means that if there is no manual standard, the statutory standard applies.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the unless requires that you follow the manual standard.
I didn't get to the question. There is a different standard in the manual. Let's just assume that.
Okay.
Okay. And let's assume the statute as it's written, so it says unless. So what does that mean? There is a different standard, and the word is unless. What do you do with that? What do you do with that?
Then, well, what we do is we apply both the manual standard and the statutory standard.
Right. And how is that different from the unless being and instead?
It is the same result, but it's the interpretation we reach.
I know. Isn't that a problem, though, that you reach the same result, notwithstanding the fact that this is a completely different word?
Well, but the statute also could have been written to say more clearly that the manual standard would apply. And it doesn't say that either.
Counsel, what if the manual had said 3 days instead of 1 day, and the same facts occurred here? She missed 1 day. Let's just say she missed 2 days, because then that would comply with the first part of the statute. So say she missed 2 days, and under the statute that can be construed as misconduct, unless, and then you go look in the manual, and the manual said, well, she gets 3 days before we would terminate her.
Right.
And don't you apply the 3 days under the statute
for
that person?
Yeah, our interpretation is that if there's a manual standard, then the level of absence has to meet both the manual standard and the statutory standard. So for that person who had missed 3 days of work, mm-hmm. it would meet both.
This boils down to, as I see it, whether or not the statute with regard to the number of two, whether or not that is a floor or a default. In questions asked earlier, it was assumed that it was a default to go to the employer manual, and the employer manual then reigns supreme. But it seemed, a lot of our job is how you frame the question. Does this statute answer the question of whether the phrase, unless the manual says otherwise, is a floor or a default?
Well, we've interpreted it as a floor. I don't think it says so precisely. And part of the benefit of interpreting it as a floor is it maintains the standard that the legislature actually did set. And my red light is on.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you,
thank
very
you
much.
All very much.
Just a few points. First, I think my friend on the other side had to make the concession that unless, under his view, would be replaced with and. And I think I can understand why the commission takes that view. Under the previous version of the statute, under former 5G, there was an inquiry into both the statutory standard and the employer policy. You had to violate the employer policy and the statutory standard in some sense, but the legislature took a different turn when it passed this bill in 2013. It struck and replaced it with unless, and that word has to have particular meaning. And moving back to deference, counsel mentioned that great weight deference has been around for a few decades and invoked stare decisis, not by name, but certainly invoked the argument. The problem with the stare decisis argument is that although stare decisis is important, of course, this court will set aside principles that are unsound and that do not aid comprehension in the law. The problem with great weight deference is that it does not interpret the statute that prescribes the standard of review. Great weight deference developed independent of that statute, and as a result, the great weight deference precedents of this court do not even discuss, much less overturn, the five or six cases from the early period that apply traditional tools of statutory interpretation.
Counsel, I have a question for you that ties into the Chief Justice's earlier question regarding 102.23 sub E, which does prescribe the scope of judicial review in this case. You agree with that?
Yes. It's a technicality that 108.09 now, there's the same standard. Yes, that's right.
But with respect to this case, so I'm just using it as an example since it applies here, would it ever be constitutional for the legislature to say in a statute that the courts do not get to review an agency's decision? In other words, is it ever constitutional? And I think this is a question that the parties understandably wanted to dodge a bit, but I think it's important here. Would it ever be constitutional for the legislature to prescribe or proscribe the scope of judicial review?
It is a tricky question. We did reserve judgment in footnote 5 on this question because the Department of Justice, in every case before it, makes every reasonable argument on behalf of a statute, so it would depend very much what the statute said. There is certainly a line that a legislature can cross because this court does have the exclusive authority to adjudicate claims with finality and with independence. The problem is that the court has also said in Beecher that the legislature has authority to prescribe standards of review. And when this court does not respect the standards of review, it trespasses on the legislative authority. So there's a tricky line there, and we do not take a position on it, but I think it would depend a lot on what the legislature said. The legislature said, our statutes, when ambiguous, do not confer discretionary authority on agencies. That would be that would pose its own set of questions. If the legislature instead passed a law that said, the court shall always construe statutes to give agency views great weight, even if it takes a different view of what the statute means, that would be a different question. These are very hard questions. Now, on the question of shared authority, I think that Justice Kelly got it exactly right when he said, there are shared authorities, but that doesn't make authorities, that doesn't mean that a party that has a shared authority is the final exerciser of that authority. I think a common example in our legal system, which the Justice alluded to, is prosecutors. If a prosecutor is going to bring a murder charge, the prosecutor has to read the homicide statutes to figure out what they mean. But that doesn't mean that because the prosecutor has to read the homicide statutes that in the criminal prosecution, the court's now going to defer to what the government thinks the law is. The reason we have courts is for the opposite reason, that courts give the final determination of the law as a check on the executive, and because the judicial branch is best positioned to give that independent interpretation to the law.
Well, doesn't every party that appears in this court where there's a discussion of the meaning of a state statute, each party has shared authority to say what it thinks the law is, what the statute means, but neither one binds the court.
That's right. Everybody within...
Is there any different from your example? Whether it's criminal or civil?
No. I think government officials have to take an oath, of course, to do that. But, of course, everybody interprets the law when acting within their sphere of authority. I see my red light is on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. When we started this argument, I noted that the students who we had expected from Baraboo High School weren't here, but then some young people came in. If the students from Baraboo High School are here now, could they stand, please? Okay. Oh, there you are. Good, very good. I bring you to the court's attention because Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who sits on my right, if you can stay in a little bit, she will come back out and talk with you a little bit, if you can stay, about processes that go on in the court and give you maybe a little bit better idea about how our court functions. So you should tell our marshal, Tina Nodolf, whether you all plan to stay for a few minutes, and if you do, Justice Abrahamson will be out. With that brief announcement, and you all may be seated, the court is going to adjourn until our afternoon argument at 1:30. Thank you all.